Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/Nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section.
Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I'm pleased to bring to you chapter 33 of the book of Eov. In this chapter, Eov turns away now from the companions whom he has dismissed to speak directly to Eov, although he's still introducing himself and his right to speak as he did to the companions. V'ulam shema na Eov milai b'chol devarai ha'azina. Now, however, Eov, listen to my words and give ear to all of my statements. The reason why I think he says ulam, however, is because he promised not to mince words, that he was going to tell the truth, the painful truth. And unless Eov should say, I don't want to hear such a thing, he said, no, really, you should listen to me. Hine na patachti pi dibura lashoni b'chiki. Behold, now I have opened my mouth. My tongue is spoken in my mouth. The word chiki is not the same as pe. Chiki word describes the inside of the mouth where the tongue is, and pe is kind of the mouth as you're looking at it from the outside. Yosher libi amarai vidat svatai barur milelu. My words are straight from my heart, meaning they are true. The knowledge of my lips is spoken clearly. The word barur can mean clearly, or maybe it means livror, means to be carefully selected, or maybe it means pure, spoken with honesty. But either way, the sense is the same, that he is going to tell the truth. Ruach el asatni v'rishmat shaddai tichayeni. The Spirit of God made me, and shaddai's, that is God's breath, gave me life. Eliyahu mentioned this idea in the previous chapter as a justification for man's right to speak. It's a reference, of course, to the creation of man in Genesis 2, where God breathed his breath into man to create him. The sense is that because of that infusion of God's spirit during the process of creating man, some of God's wisdom was infused sort of kind of by osmosis, and that gives a man a certain knowledge and a certain right to speak. If you can, respond to me, lay it out before me, stand up. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, Elihu is using legal terms in the same way that Eov used them, because he's offering the court case that Eov had been demanding from God all along. The command word, hityatsava, to stand up straight or to represent yourself, is also used in a legal sense, sort of like in English where we say to take the stand. In fact, Eov will not respond to Elihu by the end. That is, even though Elihu is inviting him to respond, he really doesn't, as we'll see towards the end of the chapter, and we'll see possibly why he does not. Heinani kificha la'el mechomer koratzti gam ani. Behold, I am like you when compared to God. I too have been made from the dust. The word koratz means to pinch out, as if God didn't use a chisel, but he pinched a bit here and a bit there at the clay, again from Genesis chapter 2, and voila, instant human. The point of this verse is that having offered a trial to Eov, he points out that since he is a fellow human being, Eov will not be overwhelmed by the trial that he's going to have with Elihu. Remember that Eov worried that if he would have a trial with God, it wouldn't be fair, since God's overwhelming presence would cause him to stutter, to fail in his presentation, essentially to lose the court case before it ever began. So Elihu is promising that that's not the way it's going to be, since you're up against a fellow man. Now notice the word kificha does not mean the mouth. It's another way of saying kamocha, like you. And the reason why it's used here is because it's a nice alliteration with the word achpi in the next verse. Hine emati lo tiva'ateka v'achpi alecha lo yichbad. You see, the fear of me will not terrorize you, and I will not smother you with my palm. This is a direct reference to chapter 9 of this book, where Eov makes a call to be heard in court. He says, im yachpots lariv imi. But that chapter focuses on God's overwhelming nature. Lo yesh beneinu mochiach, yasheit yado al shneinu, it says in that chapter, yaser me'alai shivto ve'imato al tiva'atani. Notice the same words that we have here. Just to quickly translate what that said in chapter 9, there is no one who can mediate for us, who can place his hands on both of us, a mediator who would tell him, God, to remove his staff from me so that his fear would not terrify, which means it's an unfair trial because God is so awesome. Similarly, in chapter 13, Eov says a bit more desperately than he said in chapter 9, Hinei na arachti mishpat, I have organized my court case, But mihu yarivi madi, who will come to the dispute with me? And over there in chapter 13, he begs God, kapachami alai harchak ve'ematcha al tevatani, remove your palm from me and don't let the fear of you overwhelm or terrorize me. So essentially, Elihu quotes those chapters to promise Eov that he will not smother him with his palm, just as opposed to what Eov said, that God would smother him with his palm. Now Elihu gets the actual case, and as part of the case, he will quote Eov's original arguments and then counter them. Achamarta ve'oznai ve'kol milim eshma, but you have spoken in my ears. It is you, Eov, I heard what you said, and the sound, or perhaps the kol means the tenor of the words I have listened to. And now he actually quotes Eov. Zachani b'li fasha chafanochi v'lo avoni. I am pure without transgression. I am clean. There is no iniquity with me. In chapter 13, Eov challenged God to identify his sins. Kama li avonot v'chataot pishi v'chatati hodieni. That's what he said there. How many iniquities and sins do I have? Let me know what my transgressions and my sins are. Because he was trying to say, essentially, I don't have any. And if you, God, think I have any, so state them. Also, in chapter 31, he actually takes an oath that he has no sins. So this is what Elihu was referring to. That you said, I am pure without transgression. I am clean. There is no iniquity with me. Hein tnuot ala yimsa yachshiveni le'oyev lo. Continuing to quote Eov's claim, he says, behold, he, that is God, looks for excuses against me. He treated me like his enemy. And this is also a quote from chapter 13 where Eov said, Lama fanecha tastir vatachshiveni le'oyev lach. Why do you hide your face and treat me like your enemy? Elihu now quotes a different complaint of Eov, which is also taken from chapter 13. Yasem basad ragla yishmor kol orchatai. He places my feet in a stockade. He guards, in a negative prison-like sense of guarding, he guards my every step. This refers, of course, to the ruination of Job and the fact that God responded, the way God responded to him was completely unfair. That's as far as the quoting. Now, essentially what Elihu has done is he summed up Eov's arguments, and now he is going to respond to them. Hein zot lo tzadakta, e'eneka ki yirbe eloa me'enosh. You are wrong in all of this. Here's my counterclaim, because God is greater than mankind. Now, it seems to me that this is not a response to the claim that Eov is pure, or that God has made an enemy of him. If you remember, the enemies, when they were explaining why Eov must be a sinner, their logic was as follows. Ha'enosh me'aloa yitzdak, can man be as just as God is? And this statement, which Eliphaz used in chapter 4, meant if God is perfect, and man is less perfect than God, ergo man is a sinner. And then Eliphaz amplified that point in his second speech, saying, ergo man is, afkinit avin elach ish shotek hamayim ablah. Man is foul and corrupt, and he drinks sin like water. So the logic there was, God is above you, and his being above you means you must be a sinner. But I don't think that's what Eli means here. What he means to say is, I have to talk to you, because God does not work in the way that you, Eov, demands. That is, you expect God to speak to you as a person might speak to a person. That is, after God brings punishments, he gets to come and explain to you what it is he's doing. But that's not the way God works. Madua ilav rivota ki chol d'rav lo yaneh. Why do you, Eov, try to enter in a dispute with him, with God? Because he won't answer with all of his words. And Elihu will now explain exactly how it does work. That is, man does not communicate, God does not communicate by man by ringing him on a telephone and just starting to speak with him. And that's what Eov was looking for. Ki ba'achat yidaber el uvishtayim lo yishurenu. Because God speaks, or really it doesn't mean he speaks, he conveys what he wants in one way, and in a second way, uvishtayim lo yeshurenu, but he still cannot be seen. And what I think that means here is that don't look for direct communication from God, because his existence is not the equivalent of man, and therefore words as a form of communication are not possible. And that's what he meant above in that first pasuk when he said, ki yirbe eloa me'enosh, because God is greater than man. I have to talk with you. Not that I'm saying that God is greater than man to show you that you're nothing, like the friend said, but the reason why I have to talk to you and not God is because God is way above you, and he doesn't work in spoken words. He works in other ways. So what are those two ways that God communicates with man? So first, number one, Bachalom Chezion Laila bin Binfol tardemal anashim bitnumot alei mishkav. In a dream or in night visions, as unconsciousness overcomes people while slumbering in bed. And the cool thing here is that Eliyahu is quoting Eliphaz almost word for word from chapter 4. But his point, that Elihu's point that he's making here, is completely different from Eliphaz's point in chapter 4. Over there in chapter 4, Eliphaz claimed to a special understanding of God thanks to his visions of these, the gift of his night visions and prophecy. Elihu is saying to Job that everyone gets these visions and these premonitions, that his visions and dreams are one way God communicates with man so that he can avoid sin. We call them premonitions or dreams, which fixate on some troubling aspect of a person's life, something that is percolating in the dreamer's subconscious. That's the way that God communicates with man in order to let him know what he's doing wrong. Az yigle ozen anashim uvmos saram yachtom. Then he, or in that way, he, God, opens up the ears of people and he seals it, meaning then he seals the ears with discipline or with instruction, which means he conveys his message, he lets a person know there's something to listen to, and he says what he has to say through these dreams and premonitions, and then the ears of a person is closed so that he knows exactly what he has to do. Why? La'asir adam ma'aseh, ma'aseh v'geva migever yichaseh. In order to remove man from deeds, from ma'aseh, which of course means bad deeds, and to suppress the haughtiness of a person. The word geva, once again, the aleph is dropped off, so we have geva instead of the intended ga'ava, the haughtiness, egoness, the ego of a person. Yachsoch nafsho, meaning shachat b'chayato me'avor ba'shalach. In this way, he saves a person from death and destruction. The word shachat really is a synonym for the underworld. It's a place where a person goes, but goes in such a way that he has no hope from redemption once he goes down into the ground. It's all darkness and nothingness. He, that is God, saves man's life from going the way of the sword, which means to being punished with the final punishment. So the goal of the way that man communicates with God and tells him you're sinning is by sending these night visions, these dreams, these premonitions, and that way a man can be saved from continuing on in that terrible way to the point where he is beyond salvation. And he, man, that is assuming these premonitions and dreams are not effective, then what kicks in is the second way. He will be instructed on his bed with pain, but most of his limbs will remain strong. Although the truth is, I think that the verse really has a negative aspect. We should translate "Virobat Samavetan" means most of his limbs will suffer from strong pain. In fact, the consonantal reading is not "Virov Atzamavetan," but it's "Viriv Atzamavetan," which would mean the fight in his limbs will be strong, which is certainly negative. Which means that if God can't communicate in a relaxed, easy way of sending visions and saying, "Hey, you're doing something wrong," then unfortunately, pain is the only solution. As a result of the pain, his life, meaning his desires, will be disgusted by bread, which means he won't be able to get any food down. In Arabic, the word laham means meat, so probably the best translation is not bread, but really means he will not be able to have a meal. And his soul will be disgusted by the food of desire, ma'achal ta'ava. And this, to my mind, may be a hint by Elihu of what Eov's sins really were. That is, Eov was a very wealthy person. His children had essentially daily parties. So he may be accusing Eov, rightly or wrongly, of overindulgence because of his wealth. It also matches Elihu's comments above that God aimed to suppress the haughtiness of a person. V'geva migeber yichaseh. Yichal b'saromi roi v'shufu atzimotav lo ru'u. His flesh will be finished off to the point that it can't be seen, and his bones or his limbs will be crushed until they are invisible. And this is, of course, exactly what is happening to Eov, who is covered in boils and who is scratching his flesh right off his body. Vatigrav la'shachat nafsho v'chayato lamamitim. And his soul, his life, that is because of all this pain and suffering and ruination, his life will come close to shachat, to this death and destruction of the underworld, and his life will be brought close to the end by these killers, by the mamitim. Now both shachat and mamitim are personifications of the forces that grab you and take you down to death. The angel of death, the satan, balahot, these demons of the underworld that we saw before, you know, what have you. Im yesh alav malach melitz achad mini aleph lahagid la'adam yoshro. Now this is a difficult verse, but I'm going to go with the Ibn Ezra here. If that person, who was essentially on death's doorknob, who did not repent when he got these night visions, so God afflicted him and punished him to the point that he is at death's door. If that person can find a messenger, if he has a messenger, which means an angel, as a go-between, a melitz is a go-between or a translator to God, one who can tell about man's upright nature. This reference of one in a thousand, achat mini aleph, is a direct quote of what Eov said in chapter 9, where he said, im yachpots lariv imo lo yaneh achat mini aleph. And that clues us into what Eli was saying there. So what he's saying here. So let's go through the two possibilities. Over there, one possibility of what Eov meant was that he would not, when he went to court, find a defending attorney, not even one in a thousand, who would help them take up his case against God, which means nobody would get on the losing side against God. So that would mean that Eli who was responding here as follows. If you can pull back from the brink, and God's intention with all these punishments is to pull you back from the brink, then you actually get one angel. That is, even though 999 try to bring you down, there is one who is always there to save you. The other possibility in chapter 9 is that Eov was saying that he couldn't file a single claim. That is, if he tried to sing 1,000 claims, not even one would be worthy of God to listen to. That is, God wouldn't even bother listening to it because it doesn't rise to God's level, or because God decided not to listen to him on purpose. If that's true, then what Elihu is saying here is that of all your 1,000 attributes, and even if you do plenty of things wrong, if you could find one thing which can be shown to God as upright, then the following will happen. Vayichunenu vayomer pidaehu meredet shachat matzati chofer. He, the angel that's assigned to speak about the person's one good thing out of 1,000, will guide him or will set him at rest, and then he, God, will say, redeem him from shachat. Or maybe the angel will ask God to redeem him from shachat, because I have found an atonement. This is very similar to the idea that we say in Psalm 91, which we actually recite as a coffin is brought to the grave, where an angel is assigned to guide a man, to help him on his way, meaning his way after death. And that idea that a single angel will help fight for you and will explain some positive aspect to allow a person to have a good life in the afterlife and not shachat and not death and disaster and nothingness. The word kofar is also very interesting here, which is matzati kofar, I found an atonement. It actually comes from a very solid noun, meaning pitch, which is used to line the surface. It's a gooey stuff that lines the surface of a ship or another kind of surface that it doesn't leak. And from that noun, there kind of rose this idea that a person could do an action that could plug the holes that are created by his sins and his soul. And from there, we get the idea that when you get kofar, you actually get forgiveness. So, following this forgiveness, following this redemption, Rutafash bisaro minor yashuv limei alumav. His flesh will be healed better than when he was young. He will be restored to the days of his youth. The word rutafash is a unique word in the Bible. It's hard to say exactly what it means, but the general context of healing or of restoration is understood from the context. So let's take a moment to look at what Elihu is saying. How is what he's saying different than the companion's arguments? Because he does seem to be kind of accusing him of sin, and he does say that he can't get a court case with God. But first of all, here are the differences. First of all, Eov and all of mankind can't get a trial, not because man is defective or sinful and therefore it doesn't dare walk into a court with God, but simply because practically direct communication with the deity is impossible. In fact, man can get a trial, and there is communication, but the communication is subtle. It's through dreams and visions, premonitions. If that subtlety doesn't work, then unfortunately communication becomes kind of painful. Nonetheless, it's there to allow God to communicate to man in a way that he could comprehend. Secondly, for the friends, punishment was a one-way street. You sin, you get punished. End of story. For Elihu, and this is a very Jewish, very biblical idea, punishments are not an end to themselves. They're not punishments so much as carefully selected discipline, what we would call midah keneged midah, which intend to alert man of his sin and help him stop doing it. and they only occur when the simple premonitions and subliminal hints did not suffice. So if you eat wantonly, in the case that Elihu mentioned, then you wind up not being able to eat at all. And then you get the idea that maybe the way that you're eating and behaving is not the best way. Pain is supposed to pull you back from the brink. It's not supposed to be an end in and of itself. And therefore, when the day of judgment comes, since you pulled yourself back from the brink, there is at least one saving grace that the angel who argues for you can argue to keep a person from being completely lost after death. The result of all this affliction and all this discipline is as follows, according to Elihu. Yetar el Eloah vayirtzeyu vayar panav bichua vayashev le'enosh tzidkato. He will pray to God and God will accept him. He will want him. Then his, that is his heal, the healed person's face, will shine in exaltation and man will be set back aright, or God will return him to his status of being righteous. Meaning man will strip away his own sins. And therefore, the righteousness can be returned to him. He doesn't need to argue his case. What he needs to do is recognize the punishments that God has sent and then pray, vayetar. And there's a really nice Rashi here about the word tru'ah, vayar panah b'tru'ah, which I translated as his face will shine in exaltation. But Rashi says the word tru'ah also means prayer, like yetar. And I think what this means, according to Rashi, is that the first prayer, yetar, is a lament. It's a supplication. It's, oh, save me and remember that I've done some good things in my life. After God redeems him, he continues to pray b'tru'ah, which are prayers of joy and praise and thanks. So his friends told him to pray also, but they demanded that in that prayer that he confess his sins, he asked for forgiveness, but there was no sense of personal restoration. Here, what we have by Elihu is that in the first prayer, he should recognize that maybe he's got something going for him that he could argue with God, that he deserves some restoration, and that he must promise that when God does send the restoration, and when he does put away God's his sins, that he will pray to God in happiness and in glory. The next step is what the saved person has to do after God does restore him, and how he has to explain to everybody how this painful educational process works. Yashor al anashim vayomer chatati v'yashar he'eveti v'lo shavali. He will look upon the people. Yashor might be to look, or maybe he will make his rounds around the people, and he will say, I sinned. I made the straight crooked, and it wasn't worth it for me. This is what we call vidui, or confession. But note, of course, that in Judaism, confession only comes after the sins have been recognized and put aside or fixed. There are no free rides in Judaism. After those sins are put aside, that's not enough. One must then essentially make them public so that other people don't sin as well. There's a very interesting kri in Ketiv in the next verse. Kri is the consonant, is the way we read it. Ketiv is the way it was consonantally written. So the consonantal text reads as follows. Hadan nafshi me'avor b'shachat b'chayati ba'or tir'eh. God, God saved my soul from passing into shachat, and my life was able to see the light, that is, as opposed to the eternal darkness that one finds in shachat. In the consonantal text, therefore, this is really a continuation of the person's penitential speech. It's as part of the vidui. However, the vocalic text, which we generally prefer, reads as follows. Padan nafsho me'avor b'shachat b'chayato ba'or tir'eh. He, God, saved his soul from passing into shachat, and his life was able to see the light. And according to this way, that is the way we read it, this verse is Elihu speaking again and explaining to Eov how it all works. Haim kol ele yifal el pamayim shaloshim gaver. Indeed, all of this God does with man twice and three times, which means don't even think God only gives you one chance. He gives you a lot of chances like this. Lashiv nafsho mini shacha la'or be'or hachayim. In order to bring his soul back from shacha, to lighten him with the light of life. So God gives multiple chances to man until he can recognize his sins via those punishments and repent. Hakshevi Yov Shemali. So he, after essentially explaining how the world works, how God communicates with man, and therefore what is man's responsibility in response to these punishments, Hakshevi Yov Shemali Hachareish Vanochi Adaber. So pay attention, Yov, and listen to me. Be silent, and I will speak. And here we get the idea that he doesn't really want to listen to Yov. Imiesh milim ashiveni daber ki chafatzi tzadkecha. If you have words, you can respond, you can speak, because unlike the companions, I desire your return to righteousness. That is, I'm fighting for you. However, im ayin atash mali hacharesh va'alef v'cha chokma. But if you have nothing to say, which is what Elihu was really hinting that he should have nothing to say, you listen to me, be silent, and I will teach you chokma. I will teach you knowledge, wisdom. So he gives him a chance to speak, but really he's saying, if you got nothing to say, why don't you just listen to what I have to say? Of course, we don't know if Eov therefore wanted to say something or not. All we know is that he doesn't. In the next chapter, Eov will start a series of wisdom speeches, or, well, not really wisdom speeches, but of rebukes to a certain degree, and of explanations of how God works to Eov. But actually, what we'll see is, in the nature of a wisdom speech, they're not really spoken to any individual, but they're spoken to the world at large, because the speaker believes that they have universal application rather than just individual application, and that is what he will do in the coming chapter.